This is the Bears Barroom Radio Network, and the following program is brought to you by the Vodoliak Law Group, fighting insurance companies since 1963, and TickSplits.com. TickSplits.com, no service fees. The price you see is the price you pay.
The phone. A certain magic will always linger with the very name. It speaks of courage and fervor in the world's most brutal game. 55, worn by Doug Buffon, a Chicago Bear through and through. He demanded excellence of himself and anyone wearing navy blue.
You tell me what's going on. This is moronic. We're going to get our ass whipped all the way down the line. I want somebody to get kicked in the ass and get out there and play. You're getting paid to play this game. And play it right. I don't mind you getting beat. I got my ass whipped many times. But I tell you, I took somebody down with me. You are a professional team. Act like one, for God's sakes.
Football fans, this is Buffon 55. The John Buffon Show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Buffon 55, the fastest paced Chicago Bears football podcast in the world. I'm your host, John Buffon. Barflies next year at this time. I hope we're talking about a post-Super Bowl win from Miami Gardens, Florida, and we're talking about a Chicago Bears championship. But instead, today, I'm in balmy Pennsylvania. We had a heat wave this week. Temperatures reached about 60 degrees, and we're going to be talking about the New England Patriots, 6 Super Bowl titles. We're going to discuss them with my good friend Andrew Callahan, the Pats beat writer for Mass Live News. He'll join me in about 5 minutes because, as we always do, we're going to start with two B55 segments. Actually, one, and then one afterwards. And actually, my producer, Aldo Gondia, will explain that all to you right now. Aldo, how you doing?
I am doing well, John. And yeah, for the benefit of new listeners, this is how we do this segment. I ask you 5 questions. And each question, you've got 55 seconds to respond. And it's a tribute to your uncle, Doug Buffon, who played 15 seasons with the Chicago Bears. Are you ready to go?
I'm always ready.
All right, let's do this. That game on Sunday, was it a great defensive battle, an inept display of offense, or a little bit of both? The clock starts when you begin.
You know, I think it's allowed to be both. I think the Patriots played a great defensive game, but I think the Rams threw up on themselves offensively a little bit. I mean, overall, obviously there wasn't much offense. 21 of 35, 262 yards, 0 touchdowns and an interception. No, that wasn't Jared Goff. That was Tom Brady. Goff was even worse. 19 to 38 for 229, 0 touchdowns and a pick. The difference was that Brady found something to keep going back to, and the Rams couldn't do a damn thing about it. Of course, I'm talking about the Super Bowl MVP, Julian Edelman, 10 catches, 140 yards. But, I mean, what do you want me to say? It was a 13-3 Super Bowl. That's not going to happen unless both teams struggle on offense and both teams make plays on defense. The Patriots ran it down the Rams' throat on the opening drive, and then Brady gets picked off on his first throw. The Rams had a chance to tie it up late, and Goff throws a wounded duck up in the air and gets picked off by Stephon Gilmore. But you also see that Goff was under a lot of pressure on that play. So I don't think it's a cop-out to say both defenses played well, but the offenses were pretty rotten at times, too.
I am going to be very interested to hear how Andrew Callahan asked that question. So please pose that question to him when you get him on here in about 4 or 5 minutes.
I'm ready.
All right. Question number 2. I am of the belief that Sean McVay was heavily outcoached. For example, in the first half, punter Johnny Hecker had more touches than running back Todd Gurley and wide receiver Brandon Cooks combined. Am I right that McVay's play calling was part of the Rams' problems? You have 55 seconds.
Well, Todd Gurley's usage has been kind of a mystery for a while. In his last 5 games, his highest carry total is 16, and that was against the Cowboys when he ripped off 115 yards and a touchdown. Other than that, 4 carries against New Orleans, 10 against New England in the Super Bowl. there's not a report that Gurley was seriously hurt, and apparently he refused an exit interview with the media after the season, so, you know, take that for whatever it's worth. But you give a guy $57 million in his latest contract because he can run and catch and take over a game. Well, maybe we're seeing why you shouldn't give all that money to a running back. Because if he doesn't fit into your game plan that week, or you just want to go with the hot hand in CJ Anderson, you're letting $57 million sit on the bench. Le'Veon Bell's looking on like, come on, man, you're killing my value. And his value's already taken a hit when the Chiefs plugged in Damian Williams once Kareem Hunt got the boot. So, I mean, yeah, maybe McVay isn't infallible. He didn't have an answer to anything Belichick was doing. So maybe this whole thing about McVay is, you know, a mastermind is a little overrated.
Yeah, it's a challenge when you hear people saying, you know, the guy is a genius and he's only proven himself over a short period of time. Are we jumping the gun a little bit? We'll see. He's got a long career ahead of him, and Coach Belichick did tell him, you are the future. So maybe the future will start next season for Sean McVay. All right, question number three. Julian Edelman, as you mentioned, caught 10 passes for 140 yards. He was named the MVP, but some people believe that Stephon Gilmore was the real MVP. What say you, John Buffon? The clock starts now.
Well, he probably had the best game out of everyone on the field, but the MVP is always going to go to an offensive player unless the defensive player has a hell of a game and then makes a game-winning or game-saving interception or sack. The defensive player requires an exclamation point on his stat line, be it a pick six or a fumble recovery for a touchdown. It's just like the normal MVP award. It's going to go to a quarterback unless there's a player that goes berserk and has crazy stupid stats for a winning team, by the way. I wish they'd just change that whole MVP to the most outstanding player and stop that with that valuable label, because it just might as well be the best quarterback award. If it was MOP instead of MVP, maybe Aaron Donald wins, or maybe Saquon Barkley wins. I mean, I digress. I'm getting off track a little bit, but I don't know. I would just like to see the award not be designated to certain positions, but different subject altogether. I think if Gilmore would have got it, people would have complained. Edelman got it. Some people were still complaining. So whatever. I mean, it is what it is.
You know, I think that they should give out multiple awards, you know, and they can raise revenue. NFL's always looking for ways to raise revenue. You know, they can have Chevrolet offensive lineman of the game, the Dodge Trucks running back of the game. Maybe they should consider something like that, because it is a shame that so many great performances have been overlooked, because the awards usually go to a quarterback, and if not quarterback, certainly somebody on the offense. All right, question number four. I don't think we've talked since the NFC Championship game. Maybe no. I'm wrong. So, should it have been the Saints playing the Patriots in this Super Bowl? Was New Orleans robbed by that non-pass interference call? And your thoughts overall on NFL officiating in the postseason? We begin when you begin.
Well, it would have been more fun if New Orleans was there, but I've given my thought on NFL officiating all year, whether it's the ref's fault or it's the league's fault for giving them so much to process and analyze and consider that's an impossible to actually do a good job. I've said on many occasions that this is ref ball now. The value of actually making a play on the field has diminished. Every time there isn't a completion, you hold your breath looking for a flag. Every time it's third down and the offense doesn't convert, you hold your breath for 5 seconds to see if there's any laundry on the field for a late hit or defensive holding or some other kind of bogus call. And now we're talking about replay being used for pass interference. That's a good idea on its face, but you're bringing even more subjectiveness into it, and that's going to lead to even more controversy, which I'm thinking they're trying to avoid. I agree that the game should be safer, but God almighty, when a guy has to contort himself in an awkward way so his arm doesn't land on the quarterback on the way down to avoid a flag, we're not playing a game anymore. This game isn't an actual game. It's a circus. But as far as the missed call in New Orleans, it was one of the most egregious missed calls we've seen on that kind of a stage. Did it decide the game? That's also up to debate.
It is. And I got a solution for the NFL's problems with officiating.
Robot, go on.
Robots.
Well, they're using technology and everything else. We might as well just see if we got ref bots out there to keep up with everybody.
Every time I go to the bank, I'm talking to a robot now, and there's no longer a teller. So
there's going to be a ref kiosk at some point where we just say what we need.
Very good. Okay, final question before we bring Andrew in. Now that Tom Brady has won 6 rings, there's been a lot of social media babble about who is the greatest of all time, Brady or another athlete who has won 6 rings, Chicago Bulls great Michael Jordan. So Surely these two different, totally different sports, two totally different athletes. This is like a trashy, trashy topic to even bring up. But let's have a buffoon bonfire. Who is the greatest of all time? Tom Brady or Michael Jordan? Go.
You're backing me into a corner. Look, I like Michael Jordan more as an athlete, as an idol, as an icon, as a transcendental sports figure. But it's hard to argue against Tom Brady. Yes, he's lost three Super Bowls, but he's been to nine of them. Nine. Yeah, Montana was 4-0, and so was Bradshaw. Is Bradshaw better than Brady? You're fooling yourself if you think so. Tom Brady didn't have the steel curtain, Franco Harris, Lynn Swan, John Stallworth. He doesn't have Jerry Rice, Roger Craig, or Dwight Clark. He's been winning Super Bowls since 2002. I was in the seventh grade, and he's still playing. Tom Brady is far from my favorite player, but look how he's led the team to success. Put all your Deflategate BS aside, he's led the likes of Troy Brown, Deion Branch, and then Randy Moss and Wes Welker, all the way to Julian Edelman, who was a sophomore in high school when Brady won his first Super Bowl, by the way. And I know it's an unpopular opinion in Chicago, and trust me, I don't really want to think this way. I get it. MJ was a killer in the finals, never had a game seven, went 6-0. He's the GOAT when it comes to killer instincts and clutchness and winning. I just think what Brady has done is a tiny bit more impressive.
We just lost 20 people in the chat room. Thank you, John.
Damn. Yeah, well, that's the life we live.
All right, take it away.
All right. Hey, he's one of my pals, and I'm thrilled that he's back on the show. Andrew Callahan, Patriots beat writer for Mass Live News. Andrew, what a difference a year makes, huh? Last year you were on my couch watching the Philly special unfold, and now you're down in Atlanta covering the Patriots' sixth Super Bowl championship. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really well, but yeah, it is crazy how things can change for the worse in a year. There is no better spot in New York, Pennsylvania than your couch, my friend.
I tell you what, that was a good time. We had some taquitos. I don't even know why you're going down covering the Super Bowl now, and you can watch it from the friendly confines of my basement. But I digress. I do want to talk about your experience down there in Atlanta covering the Patriots Super Bowl. I'm going to ask you the same question that Aldo posed to me earlier. For you, if you were to analyze this game, was it boring? Was it interesting? A little bit of both? Kind of give me the mood of this game.
Definitely both. And I think part of that question not only involves what happened on the field, but obviously our perception of it. So you have to take, you know, the viewers and media and fans into account. And from that standpoint, I think when you listen to everyone talking about the game in the 2 weeks leading up to it, there was an expectation issue where you expected a great game because they're two great teams, but also a high scoring game. So when you have a game that gets low scoring very fast and the quality of the game is not as great as you think it is, that's immediately an issue. Now, when you get to on the field, there's no question about it. It wasn't full of fireworks and it wasn't terribly exciting. But I think when you look at when the Rams offense was on the field, there's no question they were suffocated by the Patriots defense. You know, Goff could have played better, no doubt about it. From a coaching perspective, they were outcoached. Their secondary was lights out. Their pass rush was very effective. So that's fine. That's good football. On the other side, the Rams defense certainly outplayed the Patriots offense, but the Patriots reached the Rams 40-yard line in each of their first four drives and only got 3 points out of it. That can't happen. That's their problem, their fault. So it's definitely a little bit of both, and I think it started with just the issue of our expectations were so high, and especially for watching all the Patriots Super Bowls over the years, all of them decided by one score. This one obviously had an issue with that at 13-3.
Now, that poses a question. I mean, this is kind of a softball question everyone's been throwing out there throughout the last couple days. Did the Rams lose this game, or were the Patriots able to win this game, or was it another one of those things where both sides kind of worked?
Listen, I love you, buddy, but I hate these questions.
I know. I don't love them, but I feel like I have to ask them.
Listen, you got to address it because, like you said, there are a lot of people who view the game through this prism, and I did once, and I get it, and I think in some instances it's a fair question. But even when you want to go down to a game where someone misses four field goals, right, at the end of the day, the other team made more plays than them, and that means that they won. So while the plays the team that lost may have been easy and have been missed, they lost it, the other team won it. And I think overall, when you look specifically at Super Bowl 53, the Patriots absolutely won this game. They won it for the first three quarters, and then when the Rams tie it, you know, they were able to elevate their offensive game, a really nice wrinkle on that lone touchdown drive. And then with 4 minutes left, you don't run the clock out, but you go and get that second score to go up by two possessions. The Patriots won this. They took it from the Rams and just really beat them to a pulp.
What do you think about the Rams' usage of Todd Gurley in the Super Bowl? I mean, he's getting paid all that money and still didn't seem to be a focal point at all, or didn't even seem like they tried to kickstart him at any point in the game. Did you see that as something as far as strategic, or was that just something that fell by the wayside, or were you surprised by this? Can you kind of analyze that for us?
Yeah, I'm really surprised by it, but only in the sense of, you know, that he's such a great player and they limited his touches because, as you said, they've been doing that throughout the playoffs. My only thought is it's something behind the scenes. I know people have talked with injuries. They said publicly he's okay, and teams will do that just to hide, you know, the truth about how a player's feeling. But he looked explosive to me. He looks absolutely fine. I think it's something that they don't want to let out publicly. And also, C.J. Anderson came in and was effective, so that's a nice blanket for the issues that were going on. Because when you looked at this matchup on paper and on the field, he, in the passing game, was their greatest mismatch, working against Kyle Van Noy or Dont'a Hightower, who were crashing down on both ends of the line of scrimmage. If you split him out or get him going vertically, A, he's going to beat both of those guys down the field, but B, that'll take them off the end of the line of scrimmage and open up some of that more room. Now, Rams love to stay in their 11 and 10 personnel, so there's only, you know, one running back on the field, but, you know, I just saw they didn't use him enough, they didn't use him well enough, and for whatever reason, that's been a theme in the playoffs.
Now, we're talking to Andrew Callahan of MassLive.com. Now, in one of your recent articles, which listeners can find at MassLive.com, you wrote that Belichick dug deep into his mind to create defensive schemes to confuse the Rams. And in fact, he's done that most of the season. Can you share more about that topic where they're kind of a chameleon on defense to week-to-week kind of thing?
Sure. Yeah, this is something I published a long piece early in January after just observations week in and week out, and it's as much about Belichick being the defensive mastermind that we've known him to be now for decades, but it's also the roster that they pieced together this season. That you look at last year's Super Bowl, whether you were on your glorious couch or wherever you watched the Super Bowl, and it's largely the same roster. Like, they've got eight of the same defensive starters. They get shredded by the Eagles in a backup quarterback for 41 points. This season, they're above average unit that just happened to save their best game in the Super Bowl. How did they do it? Well, they're all veteran guys who are extremely smart, which allow Belichick to basically take his brain and put it on the field, and there's nothing that can't overwhelm them. They're making more checks, more calls, more adjustments during the season, and this is something I started asking players about because this was my sense, and they all confirmed it. You know, you had guys like Devin McCourty, been there since 2010, their safety. He said, "We've never done more than we have this season in my entire career." So it was digging into how that manifested itself each and every week. And, you know, you go back to September, they're 1-2. They got to play the Dolphins. They're slow. What do? They put Pat Chung and say, "Hey, we know you know this entire defense. Don't play safety. Play linebacker." They blow out the Dolphins 38-7, go on the six-game win streak, you know, lose a couple here and there. But this defense kept them going, especially in December when they lost Josh Gordon, beating the Chargers, holding the Chiefs for three quarters just to a touchdown. And then the Rams, the second highest powered offense in the league and a top 10 offense all time by scoring to 3 points in the Super Bowl. These guys changed themselves week to week, and that allowed them to be the unit designed to beat that particular opponent.
Now, we are a Bears devoted show, so I got to ask you this because we haven't talked to you since the Patriots played the Bears weeks and weeks ago. The Patriots were able to shut down Aaron Rodgers, Ben Roethlisberger, and they've had some really good performances. What do you think about the Bears' performance against them? I believe 31 points on Belichick's defense. Was that just was that at the end of a bad 3-game streak for them, or what did the Bears do, albeit not winning the game, but were able to do somewhat effectively on offense?
Right. Yeah. You know, and that game obviously came down to that Hail Mary, which was just absolutely crazy that they had completed. So, you know, that might have been 38 points had the Bears just gone another feet further. But the bottom line for that game to me was just their inability to contain Mitch Trubisky, which we talk about all these X's and O's and their shifts and their schemes and their ability to morph. And they did a ton of crazy hybrid things in the Super Bowl. But that was just, some things are fundamental. And when you let this dude, who is known for his scrambling ability, keep the ball, run around, and make plays, that's what he's going to do. So they didn't set the edge strongly on there. I think Trubisky made some great throws. But once they had some adjustments and they outright benched Adrian Claiborne against mobile quarterbacks later in the season, because he was their main culprit. And again, this is a veteran guy who's been around the league, had one of the highest pressure rates of anyone in the NFL this season. But they said, "Listen, if you can't just do this fundamental thing, then we're in trouble." And that's really what happened in that game. I think the Bears also had a short field or two, which will happen. But, you know, Matt Nagy had a really good game plan. Obviously, they've got good skill guys. But once the Patriots kind of settled down and kept Trubisky in the pocket, they got a couple of picks in that second half and were able to stage a comeback there.
And we're sticking with the Bears theme for another question here. Let's go back to the Super Bowl. John Clayton of the Washington Post noted that Belichick may have borrowed some of Buddy Ryan's Chicago Bears 46 defense in the game. He wrote that Belichick used what could be called a version of the Buddy Ryan 46, designed to work against the modern-day three-receiver offense, featured four defensive linemen and added safety Patrick Chung, before he left with a broken arm, of course, and linebacker Kyle Van Noy at the edges of the line of the scrimmage. Did you detect any of that 46 flavor, or was this just kind of all part of the game plan?
I think you saw some elements of that where they're lining up. You know, they were running kind of like a 6-1 where you've got, you know, as I said, Hightower and Van Noy bumped down from their linebacker positions to be on the line of scrimmage. So instead of a 4-3, it's really a 6-1. And I think that's where you see the defensive tackles lined up in that bear look where, you know, a bear defense has the guards and the center covered. So they were doing some of that, but it changed wherein the Patriots are usually in two high safeties because behind that 6-1 front, they were playing quarters coverage or some elements of that or some man coverage. So they didn't have eight in the backs like the Bears used to do and say, listen, if you want to throw on it, throw on us. But we're going to get to the quarterback first. We're going to knock the crap out of him, and you're not going to be able to run the ball. So that's what they were doing back then in the 80s. And the Patriots had elements of that. But, you know, while they're playing that 2-deep look, that's where you're playing quarters, and that's where the Patriots were able to protect themselves in the play-action passing game, which Belichick pointed to as really the second most dangerous thing after the Rams running game. So they weren't loading up the box the same way, but there were some elements of what Mr. Clayton there was talking about.
I'm going to ask you about the MVP award because I talked about it in my first B55 segment. Julian Edelman awarded the MVP trophy. Not many people were arguing that, but some people did point towards Stephon Gilmore, who also had a great game defensively. Tough to vote against Edelman. If you had a vote, who would you have picked for Super Bowl MVP?
Ryan Allen.
Okay, go ahead.
you can't give it to the punter. No, yeah. I wrote about this afterward, and you know, as you know, kind of do a little bit of a film piece. And for him, it was explaining, okay, how does an offensive player playing in the lowest scoring Super Bowl ever win MVP when there's one touchdown and he wasn't the guy who scored it? Now, Sony Michel scored that touchdown, had somewhere around 90 yards, but everyone who watched it knew he wasn't a real, you know, focal point. And the answer for me was, when I went back and looked, it's twofold. And you nailed it in your earlier segment saying, listen, the media is going to lean towards offensive players because 10 of the last 16 Super Bowl MVPs have been quarterbacks. Four others have been receivers. So we're either giving it to the guy throwing the ball or someone around him. And in the two other instances, it's Von Miller and Malcolm Smith who had game-changing plays in, you know, really defensive-dominated Super Bowls. This is a long way of saying it was always going to go to an offensive player unless the defensive player stole it. And for the Patriots, you look at their top candidates, none of them, from a box score standpoint, again, without watching the film, really grab you. Because, of course, everyone voting up there can't look at the film right away. They got to make a call. So Dont'a Hightower, okay, he has two sacks. He's coordinating that whole front, shutting down the running game. Those two sacks were his only tackles. So can you really give it to a guy with two tackles? All right, we move on to Stephon Gilmore. He had the pick. He had a forced fumble. But the Rams recovered it, and otherwise Brandon Cooks led the Rams in receptions and had 120 receiving yards, and Gilmore was shadowing him all game. So can you really give it to him? He only had five tackles. The pick was big, but also due to pressure. And then Kyle Van Noy had a sack, and John Jones had eight tackles and a sack. Their nickelback, who kind of played some safety. But there was no one guy that grabbed you, so I think the default was always going to be offensive player. Edelman provided them with their only three third-down conversions that they had all game. He counted for five more conversions after that and had receptions in all their scoring drives. They couldn't cover him in 13 points. Most of that went to him, so that's why he's MVP.
It's hard to argue against that. That's pretty ironclad there. Now, I want to say on this real quick, Tim Hasselbeck at ESPN Radio agreed with the selection of Edelman as MVP, but he was bothered because he was suspended for four games for PED use earlier this season. Let's listen to Hasselbeck's complaint, and at the other end, I'd like your take on this.
If you compete in the NFL and you haven't cheated, and there are guys that are testing positive for performance-enhancing drugs, coming off of injury or whatever the reason would be, I don't know how it can't bother you a little bit. I'm not saying that he shouldn't have. Look, I thought he was the best player in the field last night.
He was.
But I thought that he should have won the MVP. But to say that, like, look, earlier this year he was suspended for four games because he tested positive for a drug that you're not allowed to take.
Right.
Like, I don't know how guys that are playing or – listen, if you're a guy that's trying to cover him – and not taking anything, does it bother you? Like,
I almost cut off him.
At some level.
Sorry, go ahead.
And I cut off Tim Hasselbeck. I'm sure he's pissed. But anyway, Andrew, what's your take on that about somebody getting suspended early in the season being given Super Bowl MVP?
You know, I don't want to make this personal for Tim Hasselbeck because it shouldn't be. But the way I think about it is this. Big picture, Edelman obviously, you know, did what he did, and he served his suspension. So if Tim Hasselbeck is caught, you know, 8-9 months ago cheating on his wife and then throws this big surprise party for her birthday and absolutely crushes it and is the MVP of that party by bringing all of her best friends together and all the best food, and then she goes publicly and thanks everyone but him, How is he going to feel? Like, he paid his penance. They're still together. And then he's gone on and done something great. Why can't we let the past be in the past? You know, I get it that they're athletes who are looked up to and they're supposed to set an example, and there's no question about it. But the way I see it, he did what he did. He paid his punishment and moved on. And the Patriots suffer about it, frankly. They went 2-2 in September. They never do that. So he won Super Bowl MVP because in the Super Bowl, he was the MVP. And that's where the discussion should end.
And I think it's hard to argue against that. I mean, what's done is done. And then this game, which those four games he was out had nothing to do with the actual single game MVP. But right. let's just move on from that anyway. But listen, Andrew, you've been around Tom Brady for some time now, not just as a reporter, but you grew up in the New England area. Do you care to explain to Chicago Bears fans who, you know, have been yearning for longevity at the quarterback position, by the way, what makes Tom Brady Tom Brady? Not even the oldest guy here at the barroom, Aldo, I think he turns 75 next week. But anyway, has seen Tom Brady in a Bears uniform or anything like that. So what kind of is the secret? Is it the avocado ice cream? Is it the you know, plyometrics? Is it the stretching? And what is it that makes this guy just seems like he doesn't fall off? He stays consistent.
You know, I think for him, it's a confluence of different things, and this even goes back to his career at Michigan in high school, that he's just extraordinarily hardworking. And you could say that for basically about anyone who make it to the NFL. But when you look at the stars, they all have in common that they maximize their talent. And obviously they started with enough talent to where that goes on. But for him, he's maximizing his time wherever that goes. So you see that now translated into how specifically he's going to train, getting on film study, on the ride home from games, looking at the next opponent, and obviously using that experience. But, you know, for him, he's just a guy that is wholly dedicated to what he's doing. And that means making sacrifices, you know, whether with the diet or different things, that it's just all into winning. And I talk about a confluence of events early on in his career. I mean, he wasn't Super Bowl MVP of their first one. He wasn't the latter two, but those were defensive teams that won, and he made some plays at the end to carry them. And he was a top 10 quarterback in those second Super Bowls, but he was a 3-time Super Bowl champion before he was a league MVP. So he's, you know, become better and is wholly committed to that process. And you see it day in and day out where there are guys in the locker room right now who have a 41-year-old teammate who, you know, has kids and should be at home. And they say, listen, he beats me in here. I don't have kids. I'm single. He's the hardest working guy that I know. So for him to still do that at his age, it's just an unrelenting commitment to that. I think he's a smart guy on top of that. So as we said at the beginning, you know, you maximize what you have. And when you're a smart guy and you continue to raise that ceiling by finding different ways, you know, to add to your talent and to add to your ability, that's what you get as a Hall of Fame career. And I think that probably speaks to the whole organization, starting with Bill, too.
I'm going to throw you another one of these questions I'm sure you hate, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Who is better at what they do, Bill Belichick or Tom Brady?
Yeah, you were correct about my feelings in this question. But I think it's interesting because, you know, this is like a different version of a sports talk radio show. And what are we going to do for the next 6 months without real football? But the only thing I'll say at the outset is this, you know, picking one does not mean dismissing the other, because I think most people or enough people would agree they're probably the greatest to ever do it at their position. That being said, my answer is Belichick, and I feel very confident in that because I think there are names you could throw with Brady about greatest quarterback to ever do it. And when you take away the Super Bowls, which I think you should because those are team accomplishments, you know, you have guys like Peyton Manning who maybe even played at a slightly higher level, albeit not for an extended period of time than Brady ever has. The problem is he'll do it for now, which should be about 20 years. No one's ever done that. He'll have records, et cetera. But Belichick, there are no real coaches in this era or any other. And mind you, this is the most difficult era to ever win. There are more teams. The league is built for parity and randomness in the playoffs with free agency. You know, the other coaches never have to do with. I don't know if there's a good argument for anyone who could beat Belichick, who is not only the coach on the field, but the GM, and winning 8 Super Bowls, 6 of them as a head coach. He's the best to ever do it, and I think that's been clear for some time.
Now, obviously, the Patriots are riding high right now, but, you know, it probably won't be long until Belichick and Brady start looking towards next season. What kind of offseason challenges are the Patriots facing? Are they losing any key players to free agency? How are they look around the cap? Are they facing any concerns regarding age for some players like Tom Brady? Or what are some things that you think they might need to address or could be some challenges going into the offseason?
No, Tom will be out there probably until he's in a wheelchair, and the game has changed so much that you could do that safely and you just can't hit him anywhere so he can stand back there in a freezer throwing passes. But no, They do have issues, just like every team does. And I think, you know, free agency for them will start with the question of who can we afford to keep. And their second best defensive player, Trey Flowers, who Matt Nagy talked about, he's a star in the coaching world, even if the media and fans don't see it, because his sack total is always around 7 every year, so it doesn't grab your attention. Flowers is an excellent defensive end, and he can pass rush, he can play the inside, he's an excellent run defender. So for them, he's probably going to get priced at about $15 to $16 million per year. I'm not sure they want to pay that, given they can get 80% of that production at a lower cap hit. On the other side of the ball, their left tackle, Trent Brown, whom they traded for from the 49ers during last year's draft, he developed into one of their better linemen, and that's saying something when you have a top five offensive line in the NFL. So what is he going to command as a left tackle in the open market? Drew Rosenhaus is his agent. We all know his reputation. He's probably going to get paid too. And their cap space is not that great. Now, that being said, they're probably going to create some more space. First of all, if Gronk retires, which will open up $10 million, they can also cut him for only the price of two. And then they have some high-priced veteran defenders who, frankly, probably don't deserve to be paid as much. I referenced Devin McCourty, who does a lot for them in that secondary, again, like Flowers, even if his individual statistics don't speak to this. But in terms of coordinating the defense, making calls, making checks, and preventing the deep ball, he's due about, I believe it's $9 to $10 million. And that's going to be a bit too rich for the Patriots. And Dante Hightower is not too far removed from that. And he played about 15 games for the first time in his career, dating back to his rookie year. But, you know, the impact there isn't quite going to match his salary. So I would expect them to ask them for pay cuts to create more space. I think they will spend. They've got to revamp the receiving core. Edelman's the only guy signed in past this season. So they're going to have to add some more bodies there and find some space to do it all.
As we're winding down our time here, we're talking to Andrew Callahan, Patriots beat writer. This is your first year on the Patriots beat, although it's not like you haven't been around the team or you haven't been plugged in to the team your entire life. But take me through, this is kind of a personal question. Take me through the first year of being a beat writer in the NFL as opposed to, you know, you were a beat writer for Penn State in years past. What's the biggest difference, and what's been the I don't want to say wildest thing, but one of the coolest things you've experienced since being an NFL beat writer?
Yeah, so compared to college, it's totally different, and this isn't even specific to Penn State, but the access is so much more. And access means, you know, how much and how often you talk to players and coaches. So you'll have, you know, a conference call on Monday and Tuesday with Belichick, and then Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday you're in the locker room after they have practice. So that's 45 minutes of league mandated time where you can go and up to anyone and say, hey, would you be willing to talk? Now, naturally, some guys, being the Patriots, don't want to talk to the media, or they do an excellent job of saying something while saying nothing, so they can avoid us or do nothing. But the rule is everyone's got to be available at least once a week. So with college, you never go into the locker room. You get players for very little time after the game. And this isn't to complain. It's just to explain that you can get to know someone. You can have real conversations with them. You can explain that, yeah, I'm a reporter and media, and, you know, sometimes they're not going to like what I have to say. But at the end of the day, I'm a guy going home, too, who's going to watch Netflix or do whatever. And you kind of connect over just being a human being. So it's great to really, you feel like you get a feel for them as much as you don't know them. And then after that, specifically to the Patriots, I mean, like, I had guys around me on the beat saying, like, there's nothing been, you know, real big storyline this year. And I'm looking at them going, I know I'm the rookie, but you guys are nuts. Like, Josh Gordon arrives in week three. Belichick makes a clear, obvious concession of we're screwed at receiver. Then in December, Josh Gordon's gone after a two-game losing streak, the first time they've lost two games in December since, I don't know, like, you know, the dinosaurs were kicking it. So for them to go through that and say we have a boring season, it's just never boring in New England. Obviously, they don't do a whole lot of losing, and it's better, you know, post-game probably to go into a losing locker room, which is a little bit more honesty because they have to introspect and go, what the heck happened? But overall, I mean, the people are happier when they win. It's more interesting when they keep going in the playoffs. And my paycheck doesn't change, so I don't make it out to be you want the team you're covering to win. But if you talk to Bills writers right about now versus how I sound, I'm sure they're speaking a lot more slowly and they're sounding a lot less happy than I do getting to go to a Super Bowl. And it's not a credit to me. It's a credit to those guys. So, you know, the winning and just there's constantly always something going on or something being a little bit crazy. And that makes my job as someone's got to be there every day a lot of fun.
Sounds like a blast. Aldo, before we let Andrew go, any input from the chat room?
Yeah, I got two questions from the chat room and then I'd like to add one of my own. Heart4803 wants to know, have you ever fallen asleep during a Bill Belichick press conference?
No, but I do zone out. And that's the total honest truth, because you get certain questions from people. And this is even more like inside media, because I experienced this at Penn State. and I experience this now with the Patriots, there's kind of a divide, and not like a high school click sense, but of, you know, writing media versus like people who were there for TV. And we all have different objectives, but the questions asked by folks who were not following the team every day and do TV, and John used to do TV, this is nothing against him, but the questions are generally either off base or uninformed. So at that point, I'll either zone out about Belichick's answer, knowing how he's going to answer, or I'll wait for him to kind of like verbally take them out to the woodshed. So that's really the only part where I would say you're snoozing. But, you know, Wednesdays is very different for Bill because they have a lot of work to do. On Fridays, he's actually pretty entertaining and very open. So sometimes on Wednesdays, that's a long way of saying that occasionally, but not too frequently.
Give me that soundbite, baby.
That's right. Hart 4803 again and Bobby Phelan both are interested in knowing what happens after Bill Belichick leaves. Is this Josh McDaniel's team? Are we ever going to see Tom Brady coached by somebody else other than Belichick? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. In my sense, to both of those is yes, that I think McDaniels will take over. I think the only instance where you would see him leave is when we almost saw this offseason when he interviewed with the Packers, who I know your listeners are going to say isn't a great situation, but I'm sorry to tell you that it is. And it's mostly to do with the ownership and the quarterback, and who knows how long Aaron Rodgers will stick around. Because, you know, McDaniels, it was reported, was told by Belichick, listen, if you stay versus taking the Colts job last year, not only will we give you more money, but I'll let you in on everything, like how I go about my business and how we handle certain things and scouting and personnel, so that when he gets the keys to the franchise, he'll be totally ready, whereas you've seen everyone else leave Belichick's nest really flop. And that was even with the Lions, as I'm sure you guys saw in the division, just really go poorly. So part of that's on them. Part of that is just they don't have, you know, the full knowledge Belichick does. McDaniels should have that now. And with so few other opportunities in the league, you know, as great as the Patriots are from a quarterback and ownership standpoint, I don't think McDaniels is going to go anywhere. But we'll see in a year. That being said, Brady, I think, will probably call it quits before Belichick does. I don't see Belichick slowing down, even though he is 66. And Brady, you know, made a small decline this year versus his MVP campaign a year ago. So between the two of them, I think Belichick might stick it around, or they go out together. Who knows?
Very good. And my question is, I really respect your football acumen, both in talking football and the stuff that you've written about the Patriots and the NFL. So if you can, I know you probably only watched the Bears play once in 2018, or maybe more with the playoff game against the Eagles and so forth. If you can kind of give your assessment of where this young Chicago Bears team is, our followers would love to know.
Yeah, sure. You know, and I think you're spot on there. The one game that I really did study in terms of what they're doing and how they've been on was the Patriots game. But I watched their Sunday night game against the Rams, and then there was one more that I caught. It might have been a Monday night game against the Vikings that I saw. And I like it. You know, I think obviously losing Vic Fangio is a question for that defense. But just from a talent standpoint, it'd be almost hard to screw things up if you're Chuck Pagano. Pagano did have success when he was a last defensive coordinator for the Ravens, where I think they, you know, had similar philosophies, Fangio and he, but he got a little bit more creative in terms of their blitz packages and things like that. So that would be a difference that I expect in 2019. My only real question, you know, isn't with the defense or the head coach, but it's Mitchell Trubisky. And I think it was positive to see him make strides right away. I just don't know if the accuracy long-term and kind of the short to intermediate areas can be solved, which isn't to say you can't win with a quarterback like that. You just need your special teams and your defense to be at an elite level. And they've done a good job of surrounding him with talent. You know, the GM has done a phenomenal job. I think Nagy's a good coach. So this team, I don't think will have like the ups and downs that we've seen from this season to where they were a year ago. And they've certainly shored up in recent years the most important parts of that franchise. So there's stability. Now it's a matter of, okay, can we keep our ceiling consistent? Because it's certainly elevated from where they were under John Fox. And as you guys know, Mark Trestman.
Good stuff.
Oh, God, those names. man, I'm still having a little bit of, you know, flashback trauma from that. But, Andrew, before we kick you out of here, tell our listeners, because you put out some really great material, and if you're a football fan, you're going to love his stuff. He knows the ins and outs, has great input on everything. Andrew, tell our listeners how they can follow you on social media, read your stuff.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. The check, as they say, is in the mail. I'm on Twitter at underscore Andrew Callahan, Callahan being CALLAHAN at underscore Andrew Callahan.
Excellent. That's Andrew Callahan, Patriots beat writer for Mass Live News. Andrew, thank you so much. We hope to talk to you down the road sometime.
Hey, anytime, buddy.
All right, take care. Aldo, you know what that means?
Oh, yes. It means we are ready for the second part of our 555. You know what? I actually kind of thought about just turn off the clock for this segment, but I decided, no, we're going to keep the clock on.
Hey, we got a tradition.
We got a tradition. We got to keep it. We're always thinking about changing things up, but I like the clock. The clock stays with us. All right, so on this final set of five questions, I want to begin. These are all dedicated to our Chicago Bears. I want to begin with talking about the offseason priorities. Now that the Bears have locked up right tackle Bobby Massey to a long-term contract, I'd like you to share with us what you think the top five position areas the Bears need to address in the offseason through free agency, through the draft, through any other means. So if you can do that, and if you can please do it without mentioning that kicker's name, because I'm still dealing with a form of PTSD, I would appreciate it very much. So the clock begins when you begin.
Listen, the Bears need a kicker. If it's Robbie Gould, if it's Paul Edinger, if it's Maury Buford, I don't care. Get someone that can kick the damn ball through the uprights, not at the uprights. Then I would say safety. Depending on what happens with Adrian Amos, they could potentially need a starting safety, so that would be a pressing need. Then I look at slot corner. Obviously, Bryce Callahan, we don't know if he's going to be around, but that's an important position, and that's going to be an important need. So slot corner is another one. Then I think they could use another edge rusher, hoping Leonard Floyd stays healthy. But it's always good to have depth. We don't know what's going to happen with Aaron Lynch, if they're even interested in re-signing him. So that's obviously something that we'll need addressed at some point. Finally, you know, get yourself a punter. I know that doesn't sound sexy, but someone with a strong leg, hopefully someone with more a little more consistent than Pat O'Donnell. He's been a fine Bear, but I think they can do better. I think special teams needs to be addressed in general. But I if you look down through it, kicker, safety, corner, edge rusher, and then special teams in general.
I like the way you've prioritized that. Let me ask if – well, let me go to question number two, and then I'll ask this kind of off-script question. There is growing speculation that Adrian Amos will be forced to test free agency because the Bears and his free agent and his agent have not agreed on a deal yet. Now, the same could be true with slot corner Bryce Callahan. If the Bears were forced to address finding a starter at either of those two positions, who among the currently available free agents might you target?
Listen, if Amos walks, which I hope he doesn't, they're going to have to find a starter, whether they think that's internally or not. They need to find somebody. Maybe a Trey Boston from Arizona can do a little bit of everything. Three interceptions, finished fourth on the team with 79 tackles, 9 pass breakups. He's only 26 years old. That would kind of be a solid finding. Also, Tyrann Mathieu's out there, the Honey Badger, 89 total tackles, 2 picks, 8 passes defended, a little bit of an injury risk, but has really turned into a professional since coming into the league. Plays strong safety in a 3-4 defense. Maybe that works out. Looking at cornerback, maybe someone with experience like a Sam Shields out of LA. He has some concussion issues, but he also comes from a 3-4 offense would probably pick up the scheme quickly and at least would add depth if you think Sherritt McManus or Kevin Tolliver is going to step up and take a more prominent role. So there's also, you look out in Denver, which runs a 3-4. You have Bradley Roby and Tremaine Brock. Both of those guys, I think, are heading into free agency. Those would be interesting signings.
I agree with those names. Intriguing names. The follow-up to that was at the that outside linebacker position that with Sam Acho going into a the Bears have an option on his contract. They can cut mm-hmm. him and save almost $2 million. And as you mentioned, Aaron Lynch. What about Anthony Ciccolo, the outside linebacker of the Pittsburgh Steelers? I was doing a little research on him. He is a free agent. He's never really played at kind of a starter level, but I understand, based on the reports that I read, is that he's an outstanding special teams player and a serviceable outside linebacker. What do you know about Ciccolo?
Well, you know, being originally from the Pittsburgh area, right. I hear a lot of Steeler fans talking. I read a lot about the Steelers. I watch the Steelers. They really like that guy. Now, not necessarily he's not going to be a guy that you want out there every play being your starter, but that can also be a spark plug on special teams. He can make a play in the field if a guy needs a breath. I think that would be a very interesting depth signing, and I think that as a hard worker, he would learn that system quickly, and I think Bears fans would really appreciate his style.
Right, and he was a 4-3 defensive end at Iowa, and so he made the transition to a standing up outside linebacker.
Right.
So he's got moldability. He has been quoted as saying, "I'm still learning the position, so there's could be capacity there to become better." I think it's a name to keep an eye on. He could be he could be affordable, and so we'll keep an eye on it because it looks like, based on, again, what I read, that the Steelers may not be heavily pursuing him because of so many needs that they have, and I guess they got some young outside linebackers.
Yeah, and I think you could probably get him, like you said, at a pretty good value, and then it's kind of a low risk, high reward thing. Maybe he exceeds what they sign him for.
And he's got a cool name, Chickalo.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, question number three. Have not gotten your take on the possibility of the Chicago Bears pursuing former Kansas City Chiefs running back Kareem Hunt. Please share your thoughts. The clock starts now.
Look, what Kareem Hunt did was detestable. Whether those actions should keep him from ever working again, that's a debate for another time and another show. But the question here is my feelings about it. Now, we've seen that Kareem Hunt could nearly be replaced in the matter of a week with Damian Williams. We've seen third, fourth, fifth-round picks like Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen light up stat sheets. If Hunt were a QB, this is an entirely different conversation, and people are probably wondering where he's going to go and who's going to be coveting him. But I don't think that Hunt is so invaluable that you can look past all this. If the Bears would sign him, I would still root for the Bears. I wouldn't be thrilled, but I would still root for the Bears. I'm not going to lie. I would probably cheer when he scores a touchdown, but I'm not going to love the guy. I'm not buying his jersey, and I still think he's a dirtbag for what he did. And apparently, he was a kind of misleading to the Chiefs about the whole situation as well. I hope he's doing what he needs to do to address this. I think everybody has the right to redemption. I hope his mindset is that he did something despicable and he's trying to change his life. I don't think the Bears need him. I don't really want him on the team.
Very, very well said. We'll move on. Question number four. The Bears don't pick in the draft until round three. It's the 87th overall pick. Now, that pick, the 87th, has been somewhat jinxed. I've done a little research here. In history, there have been 88 87th picks. Only four have made the Pro Bowl. Furthermore, not a single player taken with that selection has made it to the Pro Bowl since 1974, 44 years ago. I don't know what your level of superstition is on stuff like this, but would you consider trading up or down to avoid the jinx? That is number 87. Clock starts now.
Leave it to Chicago to start talking about jinxes. But maybe if they can turn it into multiple picks. For the love of God, don't trade up. You don't have that much draft capital. But let's not act like a third-round pick is just chump change. You can get a really good player at 87. You can get an eventual starter, a potential Pro Bowler, a fringe second-rounder that falls for one reason or another. I'm tired of talking about curses, jinxes, spells, bad luck, yada, yada, yada. Draft the guy that you like, coach him up, and have him running through a brick wall come Sunday. The way I look at it, the Bears are basically drafting Khalil Mack in the first round, and they're drafting Anthony Miller in the second round this year. I think I'm okay with that. I think most Bears fans are okay with that. Let's see what they do at 87. Maybe there's a pass rusher out there laying in the weeds. Maybe there's another Eddie Jackson at safety. Maybe there's a corner who is just an inch too short or a hundredth of a second too slow that is going to fall to the third round and then turn all pro. Don't tune out come draft time, Bears fans. The front office has found some awesome players in these mid-rounds, and now they get to put all of their energy into those rounds because they don't have a first or second round pick.
Good stuff. Good stuff. I got a feeling that Mr. Pace is going to look for every opportunity to accumulate draft picks. You know, with that 87th pick, there are no sure things, of course, but he's done such a great job at drafting in rounds 4 and 5 and so forth. I wouldn't be surprised if he stacked up on that. I can't wait. That's going to be fun times.
Yeah.
All right, now, this final question, we typically have you do a pep talk to somebody in the Chicago Bears, and you've done some really outstanding pep talks. And so I'm thinking, well, you know, the season's over. Who in the Chicago Bears needs a pep talk? And then I said, screw the Chicago Bears. I need a pep talk. I need one. The NFL wants to take away our Bears Barroom name. In their first communique that they sent me, they even complained about the Buffon 55 hoodies, that they look too similar to licensed Chicago Bear products. I'm not looking for legal advice, John. I just need you to cheer me up. Take 55 seconds. Take 155 seconds. Take as much time as you want. Please, John, cheer me up.
Well, nothing shows success quite like potential legal action, huh? Look, we put together an awesome radio network with talented and committed hosts and the most loyal fans in the world. Listen, whatever happens, happens. We will adapt. They can take our name, but you know what they can't take? They can't take our voice. You can take the neon sign out of the window, but the barflies will still be inside drinking. They can shred the label, but Aldo will still be sipping his fancy Dominican rum before airtime. And at the end of the day, my last name is Buffon. They sure as hell aren't taking that from me. We never put this together to be a part of the Chicago Bears. We put this together to talk about the Bears, everyone's favorite subject. And no matter what label or banner or name we have to put on the door, I know all of you listening right now will still come in, share a drink, and talk some Bears football. Do I love our name? Yes. Do I want to keep flying the same banner? Yes. Do I want the NFL to realize that simply using the word Bears shouldn't infringe on anything? Yes. But regardless, the bar will be open, the mics will be hot, and I'm going to be sitting right here. That being said, I'll be back the week during or right after the free agent frenzy. Remember, this episode of Buffon 55 will be on your podcast stream first thing Thursday morning. Make sure you share it with your friends and give us a review. We're on all the podcast delivery systems: iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, Mimeograph. Look us up on the phone book. I literally had to start Googling outdated technology. That's how long I've been doing this shtick. You name it, all you have to do is search for Bears Barroom Radio Network, at least for now, and we should pop up. Aldo, what do you got?
Oh, I want to say thank you for cheering me up, and remember, Mike North Advantage is here on Friday. We are skipping 100 proof, Bears 100 proof for this week. We'll be back next week, and it looks like we're going to have Joel E.A. Bunyue as a guest. He's committed to doing a show next week, and so we're trying to book him for 100 proof. John, again, thank you very much for cheering me up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks for tuning in, Barflies. We'll see you next time. Bear down.